from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is Robert Siegel, former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Great Podversations features nationally recognized writers and journalists in candid conversation about books, ideas, and these challenging times we're experiencing. Great Podversations is produced by the University of Louisville Kentucky Author Forum. It's an honor for me to continue my long relationship with this series, which televises its forums on PBS affiliates as Great Conversations. Today, best-selling writer Nicole Krause speaks with NPR journalist Elizabeth Blair about Ms. Krause's book of short stories, To Be a Man. Nicole Krause is best known for her novels Forest Dark and Great House, a finalist for the National Book Award and the Orange Prize. Her fiction has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's Magazine, Esquire, and The Best American Short Stories. And her books have been translated into 37 languages. She's currently the first writer-in-residence at the Zuckerman Mind-Brained Behavior Institute at Columbia University. Elizabeth Blair is an award-winning senior producer and reporter on the Arts Desk of NPR. Blair produces, edits, and reports arts and cultural segments for NPR's Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition. She has reported on a range of topics, from arts funding to the Me Too movement. Blair has overseen several large-scale series, including the NPR 100, which explored landmark musical works of the 20th century, and In Character, which probed the origins of iconic American fictional characters. Blair's work has received several honors, including two Peabody Awards and a Gracie. We hope that you enjoy this great podversation with Nicole Krause and Elizabeth Blair.
Hi, Nicole Krause.
Hi, Elizabeth Blair. How are you?
Terrific. It's really a delight to have the chance to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm thoroughly enjoying To Be a Man. And there are so many big themes. And yet it's a short story collection, which I'm wildly impressed that you can manage to tackle sort of big themes in short stories. And so I've lots to ask you about, but I'd love to first hear whatever you feel like talking about. And if nothing comes to mind, what do you have going on now? What are you working on now? What sort of future projects are you hoping to take on?
Well, that's funny you should ask. I often feel like if I keep telling myself that I'm writing a new novel, that it will happen, that it will. And I am in that really strange period between books, which for me is a very familiar place by now, because To Be a Man is my fifth book. And so I know that in between, it really takes me time to find a new subject that feels urgent enough to me and alive enough to me and demanding and important enough that I will want to spend real time with it, which is what a novel requires. And I've sometimes envied the kind of writers who can write book after book, year after year, but I know I'll never be one of them. Sometimes I think enormous things have to happen to me in life to allow for a novel to be born. And in a pandemic, it's hard for enormous things to happen to any of us, aside from those in our own minds. But yeah, I'm working on a new book. The reason I started by saying it's funny you should ask is I was thinking this morning, I was fantasizing this morning about your job, and what it would be like if my job consisted of being able to talk to other people instead of endlessly delve inside my own by now well-known mind. Yeah. What a treat that must be.
Well, it's funny you should bring that up, Nicole, because as I said, I love this book because you take on some really big themes, you know, the mind versus the body, cultural roots and identity and power and sex and all those things. But there was something that did jump out at me, which is you seem fascinated, and it's not by any means a big theme here, but the nature of conversation. And there were a couple of lines that I just loved And by the way, I would love for you to do some readings, maybe some excerpts later on.
Happily.
But these are just some quotes that I just, what was them? Sometimes on a good day, that happens. As you talk, you find things you didn't know you had to say. And I love that line because I sort of feel like I'm someone who obviously thinks a lot about conversation. And I do find, even though I do it for a living, they're not easy. Conversations are not easy. And I'm just wondering, is that something I just picked up on because of my job or whatever? Or is that something you think about, just the nature of conversation?
I think about it a lot because, first of all, writing is a conversation with myself. So that line of sometimes, you know, you're talking and you find things you didn't know you had to say, well, that perhaps is even as true, if not sometimes more true with writing for me. And I'm not alone. I've heard other writers say this, that it's only in writing that we discover what we think and what we feel. Before then, there's just vagueness in a sense. And as we choose words and assemble them into sentences, we strike on meanings that feel as if they are right and they've always been there, but I'm not sure they aren't just invented in that moment. And then we attach all of our being to them afterwards. So it's a conversation with myself. It's a conversation with my past and my future to some degree, because writing is a lot about fantasy. It's about who we are, but it's also about who we want to become, how we want to change. But I want to say something about real conversation with real people other than oneself, because I have to say that's something that as time has passed, as I've gotten older, I've really come to value more and more. I think that as a young person, I spent a lot of time with my hope and ambitions to become a writer. And I knew that required a lot of being alone and a lot of sequestering myself away to think and to work. And that's good and well. And sometimes the results are great. But truly, the most extraordinary things in life that happen to all of us, I think, happen with another person. They happen in conversation, so to speak. And so I'd say so to speak, because sometimes we can be silent with somebody and it's a kind of conversation, right? And an extraordinary thing might happen. But this book is filled, To Be a Man is filled with the fossils of conversations I've had with people. I'm thinking now about the title story, To Be a Man, which is the last story in the book, that is filled with sometimes almost verbatim conversations that I had with real people.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait to hear more.
Yeah. And I think it's when we have contact with others in the world that we learn things about ourselves, but we also learn, I don't know, about other possibilities of being that excite us and inspire us and cause us to change our minds. And I think changing our minds is really why we read, why I read, why I love literature, because I want my mind to be changed.
Not to mention that it's the key to so many just societal changes if we're willing to consider another way of being. So To Be a Man, I love the story and I love the German boxer. And I love Raffi, and I love what I learn about them. And so you say these are real people or embellished for?
I won't give them away, but sure. What I will say is that story, I knew that I was driving towards it throughout the writing of this collection. And this collection, although the earliest story in it is from a long time ago, it's from 2001, right after 9/11, which is when I first finished my first novel. Most of the stories in this book were written in the last years, and they were written with the idea of creating a collection. And so as I was writing many of them, I had this title, To Be a Man, in my mind. And I knew that I wanted to write this story about a woman from the perspective of a woman like me who was in her, well, then, you know, early 40s. Now I'm mid 40s, but then it was still earlier. Who has
your baby? Go ahead.
Don't feel like it, but thank you. Who has had a lot of experience with men in her life, as most women by my age have, you know, beginning with our fathers and our brothers, if we have them, and our friends, and then our early lovers, and perhaps our husbands, and then our ex-husbands, and our lovers afterwards. And then in some cases, our sons. And I wanted to look at that arc of experience and look at that arc of observing those men who are beloved, even if they are difficult and complicated, and try to draw her picture of what she sees, of what that woman sees. And so the story has four parts. It's one of the longer stories in the book. The first part, for the listeners who haven't read it, is about the narrator's father. And then the second part is about this German lover of hers, who she calls the German boxer, because she is insistent about keeping a certain distance. She's just discovered the joy of her own independence after 20 years of being with men in relationships. And so she's not eager to give that up. And so she kind of keeps him a little bit at a distance, and she refers to him, to her friends and herself, as the German boxer. The third part is about Rafi, who you mentioned, who is a dear and old friend of hers, who is Israeli and, like all Israelis, was a soldier in the army. And it's about his experiences then, but also his experiences now in a marriage that he and his wife decide to open to other lovers. And the last part is about her sons, her two sons, who are on the cusp of manhood. They're still young. They're 10 and 13 in the story, but they're going to become men. And I hope the story becomes a whole, even though it has these facets. And it came to me very quickly. It came to me over the course of a summer in which, yes, those conversations and experiences sort of did happen, and they almost accumulated as if the story were writing itself out of life, which doesn't always happen.
I was really touched by what you say about, now can I say your father? It's a fictional.
Yeah, it's fictional. I think, well, that's a whole other subject. We can talk about that.
Okay.
But yeah.
I was touched by this idea that he had a lot of anger. I believe there's a line. I mean, you could even read it if you feel like it.
Yeah, I can find that line about, I know the line that you mean, right? About one day he goes out.
Yes.
So she says, one day over the course of many years, there is no other way to put it, he took all his great anger out to sea, let the wind out of its sails, and came back home without it. Came back home with a stillness and patience where once the rocking fury had been.
And I'm imagining this man is a certain age.
Yeah.
Maybe World War II.
Yeah, yeah. And he's in his mid-70s. He was born just after the war, although none of that is mentioned. But yes, in my imagination, that's who he is.
Yeah, it's a beautiful image, this idea that that could actually happen. You know, I was thinking about my own father. You know, wouldn't it be great if he went out for a sail and kind of came back just letting go of who knows how many decades of pent-up anger, because he comes from a generation where that was whining. Expressing our anger was whining.
Well, I want to say two things about that. I think that's a beautiful thought about your father. And I think I have seen people like my father in my life change extraordinarily. And I think that I do think it is rare. But seeing that potential for absolutely extraordinary transformation is something that had a huge effect on my writing, because I find that I am drawn over and over again, whether it's in these stories or, for example, in my last novel, Forest Dark, I'm drawn to the possibility of a person who has lived a lot and who has a kind of reckoning, who reaches a moment in which he or she understands that unless they change, that they will never get there. You know, they'll be stuck and lost. And so there's this kind of realization that something, all of life before them was based on the wrong assumption or the wrong decision. And what now? How does one change? My novel, Great House, also has a character. The same thing, this question of what if I was wrong, rises up out of her depths. And I've always been moved by that. And I think I'm moved by it because I've witnessed it. You know, I've witnessed that change in others and then in myself, in life. I know it's a sort of American idea. I think sort of, you know, Europeans, for example, might scoff at it. And I think that partly has to do with the fact that they have so much history, whereas we in America really believe in this notion. Fundamentally, it's part of our sort of fabric, our emotional fabric, that we can invent and reinvent ourselves constantly. I don't know where the real truth lies, but I do believe in the hopefulness of that possibility of change. And I'm drawn to it. And then the second thing I want to say is about fury or about anger. None of us want to be angry or furious. But I notice by now, after all these books, that when I write my male characters, I am drawn to inhabit that fury because I think as women, we don't have a chance to do it in our lives, rarely have the same kind of opportunity. I don't know if we should call it an opportunity because I don't know that it should be taken, but there's something about the ease in which men, not just of that generation, but of all generations, have been allowed to be furious, to have rage, whereas women, we don't get that for all kinds of reasons. It's criticized. We're seen in different ways. It's not excused. It's not forgivable. And so I find, you know, we talked about writing as fantasy. I find often that there's this fantasy of what would it be like to inhabit that? How does that feel to inhabit that fury? So in this case, the father has given it up. But in other cases, like there's this character, this Israeli father, Aaron in Great House, who is filled with fury. There's Epstein and Forrest Stark. There are a lot of male characters that I've written who have had that opportunity and given me that opportunity by proxy.
Yeah. Can I ask, was this collection at all inspired by the Me Too movement?
No, I mean, I was already largely finished with it kind of by then. Because remember that even though the book comes out, that's been finished a year before and more. So I think maybe it was sort of happening in the late part of writing a couple of these stories. I can't remember the timing now, but I guess what I would say is, you know, the Me Too movement was so necessary. It goes on being so necessary. And of course, it has only just further opened the question and shone light on the problem, not cured it in any way. God knows how long that will take. I do feel like, you know, mass movements, they have to be reductionist in order to be effective. And the Me Too movement did have to kind of reduce ideas and relationships that are extremely complex into more simple forms in order to make people wake up to them. And my experience with men, I have to say, was not necessarily represented by that movement. So when I was writing these stories, I knew that I was writing about men and I knew that I was writing about women. You know, I mean, these are largely stories told by women. Out of 10 stories, there's 3 of them that have a male perspective. But mostly they're women speaking about what they see about themselves and sometimes what they see as men. But I was thinking, I knew that I was thinking a lot about men here, and I wanted to draw out the complexity of what it is to be a man now, the expectations of that, the conflicting expectations of a kind of emotional fluency that's required of, that will be required of my boys, that is required of my boys as they become men, a delicacy there, a depth of sensitivity. And at the same time, there are unchanging erotic expectations that women have that are age old. And I don't know that those will change anytime soon. And ideas about strength, the expectation of what it is to be a strong man or what it is to be a powerful person. We all have to live with those conflicting things, but I think they've not been resolved in our expectations of manhood at all.
And the Me Too movement wasn't going to do that. As you say,
the
movement has to be reductionist. Just to share my own, I'm a certain age. My editor, I think she's many years younger than I am. She's a millennial, but it's great for me because it's so different how they, you know, millennial women see things. And we did a big piece. It was right after Harvey Weinstein. It was like a month after the news was everywhere and everyone was still going, oh my gosh, what does this mean? Right. And so I was asked to do a piece, why now? Why is this happening now? And so I interviewed Anita Hill. Pretty sure most listeners will know who Anita Hill is. I interviewed a young journalist who had covered movements. I interviewed some college students. And then I happened to interview Niobe Way. Have you ever heard of Niobe Way? Her whole field of study is boys, is how boys develop. And it was fascinating. I mean, basically at the end of the piece, I was worried my editor wouldn't get this, but she talks about how in many ways the problem here is how we raise boys, right? They are raised to feel a certain, they have to be the alpha or they have to be hypermasculine or their friendships are not as valued when they become teenagers as they were when they were little. It was just fascinating, just a whole, I was so happy we got that in there because even though we it was a radio piece and it skimmed the surface, at least we left people thinking, you know, maybe this isn't just about a big reckoning that has to happen. It's maybe deeper.
I think that's right. And I think there's also the opposite potential and our problem, which is that as we raise boys now in this moment with all of that sensitivity to these issues, I, for example, I have two boys. If I were raising a daughter, I think I would have spent a lot of time thinking about how to help her to be naturally assertive in ways, for example, that I didn't have when I was young, or how to insist on herself and her presence and her strength. It did not occur to me to necessarily employ those ideas in raising boys. There was an expectation that they would naturally do those things. But in fact, if you spend a lot of time raising your boys to also to really to be sensitive and to be gentle and to listen, they will also have the same issues of, well, how do we assert ourselves and strength and insisting on oneself and stepping in and not backing down? Those are all important human qualities too. And so I don't think these things are innate. I think these are learned qualities, and getting the balance right in our children, whatever their gender may be, is part of the work. And then there's the rest of the world. You know, we can do what we can do our best and do what we want, but the rest of the world educates them in many ways far more than we can. And the messages they get at school and from their peers and from the larger world, they're complicated and they're paradoxical. They're hard to work out.
Yeah. Absolutely. Another story I really love is Switzerland. I mean, I loved it because I sort of saw it as a coming of age story. And it, you know, reminded me of sort of those formative years. I think the narrator is not quite a teenager, right? Or she's 13-ish.
Well, she's looking back, right? The narrator now has two daughters of her own who are teenagers, but she's looking back at her time as a 13-year-old. In a boarding house in Switzerland. Yeah. Well, I did go to Switzerland and to Geneva when I was 13. And in fact, I had just turned 13. I find that so interesting because I now, you know, I have children who are that age. And so I think to myself, my gosh, like my parents gave me so much independence. I mean, they were living in Basel. My father was doing a fellowship in trauma, which I find ironic to know. And, but he's an orthopedic surgeon. He was doing a fellowship in trauma and Basel has the best institute or did then for trauma in the world. And, as in the story, my mother didn't want us to be learning German. You know, her mother was German and was kicked out of Germany by the Nazis very early on. She was from Nuremberg. And, you know, there was sort of rough feelings about that language and that place. And we were already learning French. And so she wanted us to continue our French. So we were sent, I think gleefully, my brother and I, to boarding school in Geneva. And I was too young for the dormitories. So a situation was found for me all the way across town in the home of a substitute teacher. So that much is true. And so there are a lot of, there's a substantial amount of real memory woven into this story. And I was curious to go back to that moment in time that feels to me so liminal, which is, you know, between girlhood and womanhood, because 13 is sort of both and neither. I had all this independence and I was, you know, taking the tram around town by myself and I was seeing things that I'd never seen. And as in the story, I had two housemates who were these 18-year-old girls who were in the 13th grade, which in this school in Switzerland existed, maybe for wayward students. But they were extraordinary. They taught me an enormous amount about life. But much of the story is made, you know, is also invented about what happened. So in the story, for the listeners who haven't read it, there's a young woman, I guess by 18, she's a young woman, who is from Iran and her family escaped the revolution, but they're sort of, you know, she grew up in a quite strict environment and she is she gets involved with a Dutch businessman who comes to Geneva on business and kind of starts a relationship with her that is very much about power and control. I did not want to write a story about a man who was sort of semi-abusing a woman. That story is deep and powerful, but it wasn't the one that I wanted to write here. I wanted to write about a young woman who, in the theater of a relationship with a man, is testing her own limitations, is discovering her own sense of power and vulnerability, where one ends and the other begins, and vice versa. And it's all told from the perspective of this 13-year-old who is watching this relationship happen and who in her mind sees it as a game and sees this older woman, this older friend, I mean, as heroic in some sense, even though she's doing something that could deeply damage herself. But the heroism of her strength, of what it is to define herself against expectations and to see how far she can take something.
I mean, it would be wonderful to have you read, maybe.
Sure, yeah. So this is a moment that comes right after Soraya comes home, and she's sort of happy again after a period of not being happy, and she's braiding the narrator's hair, and then at some point she turns, and the narrator sees this purple bruise on her throat. And yet I never really doubted her strength, never doubted that she was in control and doing what she wanted, playing a game according to rules she had agreed to, if not invented. Only looking back do I realize how much I wanted to see her that way, strong-willed and free, invulnerable and under her own command. From my walks alone in Geneva, I already understood that the power to attract men, when it comes, arrives with a terrifying vulnerability. But I wanted to believe that the balance of power could be tipped in one's favor by strength, or fearlessness, or something I couldn't name. Soon after things began with the banker, Soraya had told us that once his wife called on the hotel phone and he'd instructed Soraya to go into the bathroom, but she'd refused and instead lay listening on the bed. The naked banker turned his back but had no choice but to go on talking to his wife, whose call he hadn't expected. He spoke to her in Dutch, Soraya said, but in the same tone the men in her own family spoke to their mothers, gravely, with a touch of fear. And as she listened, she knew something had been exposed that he had not wished to expose, and which shifted the balance between them. I preferred that story, if I preferred any story at all, to trying to understand the bruise on Soraya's neck.
It's quite arresting in a way, imagining a 13-year-old listening to this story, but also how this man's tone shifts and reminds Soraya of how her father would speak to their mothers, right?
Yeah.
How her own family spoke to their mothers gravely. These are interesting connections that you've made. And
Yeah. There's this moment toward the end of the story where the narrator says, she's thinking about Soraya, and she says how a person can happen to you, and only half a lifetime later does that happening ripen, burst, and deliver itself. And I think there's, you know, this story is about many things, but it's also about that, how things can happen to us as young people that we don't understand at the time how powerful they are, but they go on opening and revealing themselves and somehow affecting us for years and years. And the narrator tells a story because now she has a daughter who's about the age of that she was, 13. And she sees how, unlike herself, her daughter is like Soraya, has that kind of desire to challenge her own vulnerability in the eyes of men and doesn't back down from it. And she envies it and she's afraid for her at the same time. And I think all of those ideas were swirling together in my mind when I was thinking about this story. But as with every story, it surprised me. I didn't know where it was going to go.
I would love to hear a little bit more about your work as the first writer in residence of the Zuckerman Mind Brain Behavior Institute at Columbia University.
Yeah, that has been a huge treat, like a real privilege to be there. It is part of Columbia University. It's their neuroscience institute. And basically, it was started by two Nobel Prize winning neuroscientists, Eric Kandel and Richard Axel. And the idea was basically to bring a lot of people who are thinking about studying the brain from different angles, basically, whether it be psychology, cognitive, molecular, computational, and put them all together in the same building. So there can be a sort of cross-pollination of conversations. So it's an incredible place. It's in a building designed by Renzo Piano, so it's not too shabby. It's a nice place to work. But I haven't gotten in there very much because, of course, of the pandemic. So a lot of what I'm doing there is having conversations with neuroscientists about what they do and trying to learn from them. And then the other piece of it is bringing to them what I do. So that involves book clubs or talking about my work or leading discussions about other books or about writing or creativity. So again, there's this continuation of this idea of, like, you know, cross-pollinating of ideas. What happens when you bring unlike minds together thinking about similar things? So it's been a huge treat. And I, you know, again, we started this conversation by talking about, you know, how hard it is to get out of one's room as a writer. This has been like one of the great opportunities to do that, to kind of leave my writing room and be in another world. And as different as scientific thinking is from my kind of thinking, which needs no proof, no evidence, is purely speculative, I have learned really an enormous amount from them. And I will be interested, I'm sure they will be interested, as a first writing residence, to see where it goes. But it's now been endowed and it will go on, this residency. And so that's really rewarding and wonderful to know too. And I'm just feel excited about that. I think it's a great thing for writers, and I think and hope for the Institute as well, to have them there. I should say there is also an artist in residence, and this year it's Julie Maritrou, who just had her show open at the Whitney and who is an extraordinary artist.
So having neuroscientists read your work, because you do address a lot about the mind and memory, and any particular nuggets of wisdom they imparted or feedback they gave you that said, this is beautiful, but not quite?
Well, no, I think, I mean, everyone is too kind for that. I think there's been a lot of that sort of shared joy of, wow, you think about the things that we think about. We aren't all that different. And I've heard back from them that they have found, I guess, a lot of familiarity in my work, because I do write a lot about memory and how we process the past and about how the mind works. You know, I, of course, you know, when I talk to them and I interview them, I want to ask them things that they scoff at and laugh at me, because they're basically philosophical and unanswerable questions, like, what is the nature of consciousness and does free will exist? And they sort of laugh at me because they're really working on motor reflexes of the fruit fly or whatever, the memories of caching with certain kinds of birds, how birds cache seeds. And, you know, of course, people are working on humans too, but the number one takeaway that I've learned is there's so much we don't know about the human brain. And so I guess in that sense, their work is speculative too. But I don't know, I think it has changed my thinking a lot. It has changed how I think about memory. I don't know if it will change how I write about it or my characters. That we'll have to see. But in my daily life, I find how I'm processing the world and thinking about my past and future has kind of changed, given how much I now know about how memory might or might not work.
Fascinating. How has it changed your feelings about memory?
Well, I mean, one of the ideas that is fascinating that is now, I guess, old news to neuroscientists, but was somewhat new to me, is that memory is really about, probably largely exists to help us predict the future. So it isn't about a record of the past. It's about how we are going to make decisions about how to live or what to do going forward, whether that's in the next instant or in the next month or the next year. And that explains partially why our memories of the past are so changeable, right? You know, this is something I've known for decades too, from like early reading of Oliver Sacks. But of course, our memories aren't in any sense an accurate record of what happened, nor does the brain need them or want them to be that. We have other higher orders of reason of what we need. And what we need is a sense of coherence. We need a sense of a reading of the world that will help us go forward and decide how to live, how to be. And so that's interesting to me because, like, you know, old fights and conversations about who said what and who did what are just like completely and utterly irrelevant, right? And we're constantly reconsolidating the things that we remember in order to update them to what we feel and see and want now. And so I guess there's this little reminder constantly in my mind of when I'm going over something or remembering something to just say, like, probably didn't actually happen that way. So, you know, what is it that I want going forward that this memory or this thought is now reflecting on?
And so do you have different feelings about your future?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know if
and maybe too difficult to answer in two minutes, but
not difficult to answer. It's I don't think my sense of the future has changed because of time that I've spent in the Neuroscience Institute. But I think my sense of the future has changed because that's what happens as we get older and as we live more. And it's odd and ironic, but even as we have less time left, having lived more, I think we feel, or I feel in like middle age, that actually there's enormous potential in life to change, that even as we have less and less of a stage on which to enact our fantasies and hopes, that actually there's a sense of real possibility for that. I don't feel a diminishment of that. Oh, we've lived a lot and, you know, that's what it is. You know, I feel, yeah.
What else is there to do?
Yeah, I feel this sense that life sort of keeps opening. And maybe as we have less time left, there's that urgency that creeps in. What do I want to do with it? How do I want to live to have the best possible life? Maybe that seems too optimistic, but I really do feel that.
Well, Nicole Krauss, it has been such a treat to talk to you.
Thank you.
I feel enlightened and rejuvenated in some ways.
Thank you.
And I don't know if I'm supposed to ID your book, but Nicole Krauss's new book is called To Be a Man.
Thank you for having me and for talking to me, Elizabeth. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise.
Please visit KentuckyAuthorForum.com for more information and for show notes on today's podcast. And please take a minute to rate and review Great Podversations in your podcast app. Great Podversations is distributed by Louisville Public Media. It's a production of the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. Mary Moss Greenbaum, producer, Evie Clare, associate producer, and Leslie Sissel, consultant. Great Podversations is supported by Bittner's, Brown-Forman Foundation, the Geens Foundation, James Graham Brown Foundation, and LDG Development. We hope you enjoyed this Great Podversation. Thank you for listening. And I look forward to your joining me for the next Great Podversation.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.